I'm going to take a semicircle here, but I'm going to push it all the way out to infinity. And what happens is I have e to the I omega t plus if is e to the minus omega s e to the I, sorry, r plus if I omega r. Well, that's a bound place. This is a decay exponential, and as I'm taking s off to infinity, this is going to go to zero.
But it's minus.
So well, that's what makes it go to zero.
Okay.
Yeah, I squared. Okay. So I ran through that quickly. You guys want to see it in detail?
I don't think I've ever seen this
contour integration. Pick up an intro book on complex analysis. It's not a difficult subject, and it's really kind of cool. Or, you know, something like Arskin would treat it. I think he's got a little section that reviews the basic ideas pretty quickly. Maybe that's a quicker way to get it. Just read a couple of chapters in Arskin.
Taking 53
Yeah, you can take a whole course in the math department, or you could read two papers of Arskin.
It's a course here. It's like the math methods they offer here by Bayless.
Math methods. Oh,
right.
Yeah, that'll probably come.
Yeah, he covered that.
Yeah, he would do that in math methods. Yeah, it's a fun technique. It's, you know, some beautiful stuff happens in the complex plane. And that's what we're doing. So, have you seen that? Have you done that?
Mm-hmm.
Any questions on what were we doing? The green function for the wave equation. In case you actually want to do some waves. What is this class? A field?
Right?
That's a field. That's all right. There. That out, that in. Okay, are we ready to quantize the Dirac equation? Is that the next thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions on previous stuff?
I'm still working on that previous stuff, but...
still working on what?
On that previous stuff, but...
Oh, okay. Do you have questions on
it? No, not yet. No, everything's good.
Now, let me tell you. I've created a website, which I keep finding stuff to load onto. Turns out, 7 years ago, I wrote a quantum field theory book. So I put it on.
Oh, okay.
You might find that nice. It does things sort of the way we've been doing them. So, actually, without assuming some of the things that I've told you in previous terms, so you might find this refresher helpful. I think the quantum field theory site still links to it. If you go to seminar, I think I changed that link so that it now goes to the new website. But if it's not there, go to the physics webpage. Go to faculty and go find my picture. Don't worry about the picture. You know, click on that website. That's a personal web page or whatever. There's a web link there. And that'll stay there even after they pulled out that course. So go to the physics site, faculty, find me, click on that website. And it'll take you to something that should be useful for you guys, because I've put up all the notes from the past, so the general relativity, the gauge theory, and this class, you know, all of the links to those three classes are on there. Various papers, I put links to these gauge theory papers that Juan's been reading, and some summary text files that I wrote up relevant to the gauge theory class last spring. I think a lot of you guys already have a lot of those papers, but it's all there in one place, and maybe this will be a place where we can keep things as we find them.
What's the address?
No clue. let's see, what's the physics department?
www.physics.usc.edu.
Oh, okay.
No, not to the To your address, to the website. So not to the
okay, website. I don't know. but if, yeah, just go to the USU Physics.
Okay.
And, yeah, find me, and it's the link right there.
I think it's for the faculty and staff to the right. Yeah, you know, it's got everybody's picture of me.
Yeah, it's got nice picture of me. If you have any trouble finding it, just send me an email and I'll send you the web address.
Okay.
I never use web addresses because I just find ways to click and link to stuff, but I'll be happy to send it to you. And the quantum field theory book that's on there might actually be helpful. So, I just went through this morning and edited so it works in Wix.
Oh,
it had like 50, compilation errors when I tried to PDF it.
like Laura just
so I went through and changed the old tech and the new tech, and now it works fine.
Part of the problem also, I think, in the very beginning, like the what do you call it? Nothing ensemble.
The header stuff?
Right.
Yeah.
He screws like something out or him.
Yeah. But it was working fine. And I loaded the PDF on the website. So that should be right. There's also the mechanics book is on there. Any of you who don't have time, the mechanics book. Also a work in progress. Any comments on any of the stuff on there? Are welcome. So let me know if you spot anything that looks like here's a three-page calculation. You could have done it in three lines. I know one case where that occurs at least. So there are always a little bit better ways to say things. So don't hesitate to point out where something is unclear or just stupid or whatever.
Is that quantum mechanics or is that
quantum field theory? Well, classical mechanics.
Oh,
classical mechanics. But I try to do the book from the point of view of modern field theory. So functional derivatives, I treat. I'm 100 pages into it before I get to Newton's law. I mean, it starts at a more philosophical level than that. I started with wondering how many dimensions we live in and ways of determining that experience. You might find it an enjoyable book. Have you read the mechanics
there? A lot of it, yeah. So it's pretty good stuff. A lot of stuff they covered in gauge theory too is in there, that mechanics book.
I try to make it kind of gauge theory prep. so it's got some stuff that you don't always see in what school.
Right.
So I don't know. Do you remember the Dirac equation?
D dash. Put a plus or minus.
Point. I'm going to just write that again. That's just really ugly. I believe we'll run into no difficulty if we take it to be psi bar I d phi h minus m psi before x. You can take half that plus its complex conjugate. The two differ by a divergence, and so the essential physics will be here. And it's just simpler to deal with this version. So we need to write the Hamiltonian formulation of this, then we'll impose canonical commutators and do all the stuff we did before. So, a couple things we need. We need a solution. We need the conjugate momentum, and then we're more or less off the run. So if we vary S with respect to psi bar and set that equal to 0, that's I d slash minus m psi, and that's the Dirac equation. If we vary psi instead, we have to integrate by parts, and what we get is the conjugate to this equation. So it's already implicit in there. The fact that the action is in principle is real up to a divergence, let's say, means that there won't be anything different if we vary the conjugate. So we want to solve that. We make the ensemble that psi is some spinner, what should we call it? Let me call it chi, e to the minus I t dot x. This turns it into where chi is some constant spinner. So it's a four-dimensional complex vector, but it doesn't depend on x or t. All the Dirac dependence is in the space. So we get I d slash minus m psi, right, that has to be 0, but acting on the t to the I t dot x pulls down a minus I t and gives t slash minus m acting on chi times the exponential. And we can cancel the exponential, and now we have an algebraic equation, t slash minus m chi equals 0. To solve that, yes, one.
I'm sorry, I don't know what this.
Oh, the psi means. For any space-time four vector, take any four vector, mu. Take the gamma matrices, gamma mu. You know the Dirac matrices. All right, so then A slash is defined as gamma mu A mu. So any four vector contracted with the Dirac matrices, you just write it with a slash. So d slash is d mu. It's gamma mu d mu. Right? It's that sum. Sure. So let's go to the rest frame. And this is nice because we know that in general E is plus or minus the square root of C squared plus M squared. In the rest frame, the momentum goes to 0 and we have the energy is just plus or minus the mass. So we have positive and negative energy solutions here. Even for the Dirac equation, Dirac invented it to try to get rid of the negative energy solutions, but they're not actually a problem. There's the antiparticles. So we just keep them and go. So we want to solve this equation. Let's take the gamma matrices to be gamma 0. We can have an identity, minus identity. And for the gamma I, poly matrices, minus poly matrices. Anybody remember where we had the minus sign? But these four matrices work as a set of gamma matrices. Yeah, that works. It's an allowed set, but the work that does. Then, t slash minus m, chi, is going to be, all right, t slash, b is 0, e is plus or minus m. So, this is going to be, so for E equals plus M, we'll have, right, this is gamma 0, this is gamma I, so T slash is E times gamma 0, so we're going to have minus M, M.
He has a minus backwards for the two sigma polys. I think it's the other way around. Minus, right, yeah.
Minus plus, okay.
Yeah.
Did I do this wrong?
No, that's right.
That's not right.
Well, let's see.
That's backwards.
Oh, yeah. Oops.
Minus. There we go. Okay, and then we have M acting on chi, that's the zero, that says that, okay, zero, zero, minus two M, minus two M, acting on chi. Let me write chi as a two-component spinner and another two-component spinner. So U is some alpha beta, and this has to be zero. And that will be the case only if 2m times u tilde equals zero. And so for positive, for energy equals plus m, we have the solution u zero for time. All right, so the upper two components. Well, I guess what happens if we have minus n, the other two being that gives us z. So if e is minus m, then we have the same thing except minus m for the energy, plus m, then mass everywhere acting on chi. Call it chi minus equals zero. So let's write chi minus. We could call this let's not worry about. Chi minus v. Let's see what's gonna. Let's call it v tilde v. Then what we get is minus two m up here. 0, 0 on d tilde and d equals 0, and that gives minus 2m d tilde equals 0, which gives d tilde equals 0. And so we have chi minus is 0 in the top two positions and d in the bottom two positions. Question one?
Either one.
No, I'm just wondering, don't we have to include all the polys in here as well? You only included the gamma zero. Yeah.
Zero.
Oh, okay.
We're in the rest frame.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right.
So, okay, you're going to have to boost these to find the general solution.
Okay.
And I'm not going to do it. Exercise.
Okay. All right.
I think I already gave that as an exercise, in fact. So, this is what they look like in the rest frame. Then in the rest frame, we also show that the spin operator, this is just spin up and spin down, spin up and spin down. Yes, one.
You said two-component vector?
V is a two-component thing, yeah. Yeah, it's like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, V looks like that as well.
How can you multiply it by four components?
Two. There are two components here, two components here. Each of them. This is very common. Right. These are 4x4 matrices, but we write it using a pair of poly matrices. You know, think of this as 2x2 blocks inside the four-dimensional thing. It's just a shorthand for writing it. It breaks it down into terms of things we're familiar with, like a poly spinner, you know, in the Schrodinger equation, it couples with magnetic fields, you know, look at the Zeeman effect, something like that. You got a little two-component spinner there, spin up and spin down for the electron and the hydrogen atom. That's what this is. That's the little poly spinner sitting there. And we show that rotations on this, okay, you have a spin up eigenstate and a spin down eigenstate. So in fact, let's define two of these. Let's define a spin up one and by 2 to be the spin down one. Then I'm going to use a funny normalization for U and V, but U is going to be, it's two components, let S equal 1 or 2, so we're talking about this two component spinner, and I can write U as the square root of 2E times psi S, and V the same way. I believe it's root 2e psi s. science. So, where S is just an index now, one or two. There are a bunch of relationships that you should prove. Let me see where we talked about this. Yeah, pinch, yeah, equations, 3.109. Okay, a whole bunch of identities. 109 to 170. So, action stuff. There are a bunch of identities involving these guys, and it's just a matter of taking inner or outer products of these. They deal with U is going to be US and zero, B is going to be the four component spinner, B and B S. In general, we can boost these. And what's our boost operator look like? Boosts are Hermitian generators. So it's just a Pauli, no I.
Okay.
And we could really use the sigma mu nu, but we want the sigma zero I with some parameter W I. Probably will want a half in there, but you want the Hermitian form of this. And I think this is Hermitian already. Yeah, it is. We've had that before. So these are the boost generators, right, where sigma mu nu is the commutator of a pair of gamma matrices. So sigma zero I, you take the commutator of gamma zero with gamma I. And it's just something built out of the Pauli matrices. You can take this representation. That almost looks like a commutator. Just figure out that commutator. Then you've got it. I'm racing through this because we did it already. We are racing through this, but you're catching up fast. Okay, so as we do the quantization, we'll probably refer to these normalization conditions. The U and V are orthogonal to one another, and that orthogonality will be preserved by a boost. So even in a general frame, these will be orthogonal. The outer product of U with U dagger, if you build a matrix by taking an outer product of a pair of U's and you sum over S equals 1 and S equals 2, so there are two different spinners here. That's redundant notation, right? I've used the same symbol for a four component thing and a two component thing. But
what's both?
You can take that to be the problem. Right. If you sum over the outer products of all four of these, you build some matrix. Well, it's something like P slash minus M that you build. Okay, you actually build something that looks very much like this. That's a useful fact. We'll need that fact when we do interaction. So have a go at these identities. As we work through the quantization, I'll draw freely from those. If you want to go back and have a group prove some of those, we can certainly do that. For today, I'll assume it, but after you take a look, you know, we can sort through any details that are emerging on that. They're pretty easy things. You're just taking out a product of vector. Once you get the idea of what you're doing, it's not actually hard. So, questions?
Yep. How can we tell we have opposite charges, you know, when we're looking at the top or the bottom?
That's going to come out of the quantization.
Okay.
Charges come out of the quantization.
Okay.
And we have to come back and write the full solution. Remember, this is all one Fourier mode. So we're going to take the full Fourier superposition of these guys, just like we did before for the scalar field, complex scalar field. We're going to take the full Fourier superposition of these. The thing is, the solution has this chi in it, as well as some Fourier amplitude and the Fourier oscillating mode. So instead of an A e to the I p dot x, or minus I p dot x, we're going to have an A and a U or a V and an e to the minus I p dot x. So we'll have three things sitting inside these integrals. So they're vectors at the same time that they're these space-based functions. That, I'll write that for a little bit. Any other questions on what's up here? Good. Okay. So, hoping that's enough to get us started here. Let's come back here and write the general solution. So, wave function. We have, remember, the Dirac spinner also satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. So we can write the solution as a four-dimensional Fourier integral with a delta function on the energy, e squared minus q squared minus m squared, has to vanish. That would give us the positive and negative solutions. So we do the integral over the delta function, and we get the same thing we got before. And we've chosen the normalization, so even this normalization is the same. Then, let me be sure I get this right. The solution right, so we have some mode amplitude A, and that depends on T like before. It also depends on which spin is, because remember we have two components for U. So we not only integrate over momenta, we're going to sum over S equals 1 to 2. And then, let's see, that U also depends on T. Because, is that right? Remember, we do a boost. Okay, this was the rest frame. We do a boost to general momentum. So whatever the momentum is going to affect the solution. This is the rest frame, but there's also a sigma dot p thing in the general frame. And so that basis spinner is going to depend on the momentum, just like the mode amplitude. And then we have e to the minus I of p dot x. Then we have the antiparticle piece, and we're going to write that again with a B dagger. It's a complex field, so we have a different amplitude here for the dagger. Depends on momentum, also depends on F. And remember, this was the negative energy solution. Alright, we integrate it over a delta function, we get two terms, because it's delta of e squared minus stuff. So we write that as the sum of two delta functions, and we get the two terms. So this is the one eigenvalue of energy, this is the other eigenvalue of energy. So we have Vs of t, e to the I, t dot x. So pretty much the same as what we've done, except we've got these spinners floating around that we also have to deal with. Then we need conjugate momentum. Okay, Ed, questions on this? Does this make
this,
sense?
The U and the V are both centers, right?
Yes.
So they four or two-dimensional spinners? It should be four.
They're four-dimensional spinners.
Okay.
Those are the big ones. Yeah, those are these guys.
Okay.
Let's call this, something else. Alright, okay. So they're the four components.
Why do we do it like this instead of why do you put a V on the second term instead of a U?
Okay, I was trying to say, remember how we got to D3T? We had integral D4X of a general Fourier coefficient. And let's see. There's a delta in e squared minus n squared.
Right.
And let's see, we've got the e to the minus y, the e dot x. And we've got the sum, so it's the spinner solution here. Okay, this delta gives us 1 over magnitude of the derivative, 2e, sum of two delta functions, delta of e minus root t squared plus n squared, plus delta of e plus, the negative energy solution, t squared plus n squared. Right. So, you do those integrals, that's a momentum integral here. You do those two integrals, it gives you two terms. And the two terms correspond to positive and negative energy. So we have to use the spinner that has the corresponding energy.
Okay.
Right. So that dictates that this is a V and F.
Okay.
And then remember we did that trick changing the coordinates to make this an IP dot X again. Even though it had a negative energy up there, so it looked like the wrong signature.
Right.
We take
it. Right, yeah. I remember that.
Okay. Are there other questions on this? So this starts to look fairly reasonable. So we're doing pretty much the same thing, except, okay, like I said, each new field you do, all right, you've got some new issues to deal with. The issue here is carrying along these basic spinners. The algebraic part is the solution to the Drac equation. The U and V guys. Okay. Sum 1 to 2. So now notice what we've got here. We have a sum of four solutions, right? I mean, S equals 1 and 2. It's a sum over a complete basis for that spinner space. So the solution to the algebraic Dirac equation span the space of spinners. Right? We get a complete basis there. They have certain functional dependence within each one, but you can build pretty much any spinner out of them. So any spin state can be constructed in terms of these eigenspinners of the Dirac object. Okay. Step on. We need the conjugate momentum is the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to y dot. And, okay, there's a psi dot in here, because there's a gamma 0 times the GDP. That gives us psi dot. So we have, there's an I psi bar, gamma 0, and then the rest is psi dot. So that's the conjugate momentum. We can simplify that if we want, because phi bar is actually phi dagger times gamma zero. So we get a gamma zero squared, and this is just psi and psi dagger is the conjugate momentum. That's a lot like the complex scalar field. We had a similar thing there only it was there was a time derivative. Since the Dirac equation is first order derivative, the conjugate momentum is actually just a function, which is weird, but it still works.
What are you thinking of these derivatives?
This is the Lagrange density here. So, remember this is this sum, so there's a time derivative in there, multiplied by gamma. Okay, so the Hamiltonian density is going to be pi phi dot minus the Lagrange density. And I can write that as I phi bar gamma zero phi dot minus, right, what is L? Well, let me break L out a little bit. We have phi bar I gamma zero phi dot, and we also have the spatial one, phi bar I gamma I partial I of phi. So writing out this term in detail, and then we also have minus L, so there's a minus M phi bar phi. And now a weird thing happens. Those two terms cancel, so we don't seem to have any kinetic stuff at all. And we're left with minus I phi bar gamma I. It's just a spatial sum now. No time derivatives in here. And then we have plus M phi bar phi. We can write that maybe more compactly as phi bar minus I gamma I di plus M. So that's our Hamiltonian density.
It always looks so weird that that's what it is. That's exactly what Matthew already got as well. So
what do we need to do? We need to write the momentum density, pi. This could be written in terms of pi. Maybe that's worth doing. So, in terms of pi, the Hamiltonian. This is phi dagger gamma zero. So if I I could pull an I out of there. Put another I, pull an I out. Okay. So I could write this as pi times then what's left. There's going to be gamma zero. Then we have minus gamma I partial I. And I pulled out an I, so I have a minus I M now. Times phi. Check me on that, but phi bar is phi dagger gamma zero. So if I pull an I out, then I've got a phi. That looks good. So I can write the Hamiltonian in terms of pi and psi that way. Now, let's see, what do I want to do? We're gonna need pi. So we have the sum on S, we have the integral d3t over 2 pi cubed root 2e, and then We need I times by dagger. So we need to stick an I somewhere. Let me just stick it out front. And then we need to take the dagger of this operator here. That means we're going to need the conjugate for the use. So we get A, C, and F dagger. We get U, F of P dagger. E to the I, C dot F. Plus D of P and F. DF is dagger. And e to the minus I, C dot F. So, there's pi.
Okay.
Now we need to invert these. So we take the Fourier transform, and then here's where we're going to have to use orthogonality properties or something for the U and V spinners. And we'll just have to sort that out as it comes. But
what is the vector type?
Four vectors. Yeah. When I just use the symbol p dot x, I mean the four vector space time dot. The metric here, by the way, the space time metric is plus minus minus minus. Okay. So let's try and invert something. If I take the integral of psi. And I multiply by e to the I q dot x, and I integrate over q3x. That's the sort of thing that I select as A and other stuff. So we have a sum and an integral q3p, 2 pi q. Root twice e t. Then we have A of T and F, U F of T, E to the minus I, T minus Q dot X, and then A of T and F stagger to V F. E to the I B plus Q dot X plus print B3X. We do the integral over X, we get some delta functions. So three spatial integrals is going to give us three delta functions from the exponential. And that will cancel the 2 pi. So we have a sum on f, we have an integral b3t over root 2e, then a to tf, uf, del 3 of q minus q, then there's an exponential in the energy, but Et equals Eq because of the delta function, so that drops out. Then we have B, Bf dagger, Vf, del 3 of Q plus Q, and this one still has the 2i Et, which we sort of hope goes away. Oh, this is psi, not pi. I'm putting in this one. So, when we do pi, remind me again and I'll put the I. We need to do the same thing for pi. But this is just a wave function, not pi. So now we integrate over the delta function, and we have a sum over spin state. We have 1 over root 2 E. We have A of TS US. There, nothing depended on Q, did it? All the Q dependence was gone. Was it? Was there Q dependence anywhere before? Maybe not. Anyway, we get fairly simple stuff here. Okay, now we do the same thing for pi. Let's see. I wonder. I can't quite do that. Let's just do it again for pi. Someone has integral d3 t 2 pi q root 2 e for n. And now a dagger of ts, us dagger, the integral over x, I'll do these two steps together. So the integral d3x is going to give me delta functions again, so I'll end up with del 3 of, this time it will be t plus 2, and then for the second term, here's pi, we want this, we have b dependent on t and f, bf dagger, and del 3 of b minus q. Both branches. And we do the integral over the delta function, and we have I sum on s 1 over root 2 e, then a dagger, so t as us dagger, delta function goes away. Oops, this is, no q's to set equal to anything. So,
that's weird, but I guess that's okay. Oh, I guess we could set all the p's to q's, or,
so you need to do that, because the integral on the left is function of q?
It is the function, yeah, okay. So, yeah, these delta functions should have made all the p's into q's. This should be a minus q. There we go, minus q. This depends on minus q, thanks. That's better. So, everything is Q. That. Now, this will be minus Q and F. This U depends on minus Q. Then, the second term, B, is Q and F. D, F, dagger. And we got it. Okay, now we still have a sum over s equals 1 to 2, so each of these things is a sum of four terms. So to get the mode amplitude out independently of those basis spinners, suppose we could multiply by something. We could multiply by some basis spinner. Let me see if he gives us a hint here.
Do you have exponential term, the exploratory term?
Oh.
Should there be one there?
Yeah. On this one. E to the 2i plus e to the
t. Are you saying t equals 0?
Is it plus or minus? Should have been here too. Alright, what was it? This one then. Plus so it's going to be fun. E to the 2i. Okay. So, now, getting... Actually, no use out. We need to ponder that a minute. If I take an inner product with one or the other, yeah, I should be able to just pull out those terms. It's the vector equation. And U and V are independent vectors, and F equal 1 and F equal 2 give me independent vectors. So really, each of these conclusions we've reached is the sum of four terms. Each term is multiplied by a complex four vector. So if I just dot the whole expression by one or another complex four vector, another U or V, then I can pull out whichever term I need. So I just need some orthogonality relations. Which ones? Let me write a few
up. So S is from 1 to 2, right? S goes from 1 to 2?
Yeah.
All these, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, here are some orthogonality relations that we can use. These are among the equations I asked you to check. And these will hold in any Lorentz frame. So if I take the inner product of U bar with Us, and these are both at the same momentum, then this should be like a Kronecker delta, right? If one's spin up, the other's spin down, those are perpendicular to one another. So I ought to get a Kronecker Rs with some normalization. Normalization of 2m.
What does that mean? It was just like.
Sorry?
Is the Kronecker with 2 raised to the is that what we have? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the usual thing is 0 unless r equals n. But yeah, if you keep these then.
Okay.
We're in a complex four space. We can choose an identity metric. So. Think of that as the inverse metric on this space. Does that work? Yeah, it's only two dimensional. That's not quite what it is. It's just a Kronecker. The R and M. It's just the labeling for the different independent spinners.
And this part, what is what we have to prove for one of the exercises that you get one for? Or?
Yeah, basically you're showing that 2m is the right thing in front of that.
Okay.
It's clear, remember in the Rentz frame, we had u1 was root 2e10, u2 was root 2e01, and in the Rentz frame, E is M for the positive solution. 0, 1. So if I take U2 bar with U1, okay, there's the 2M, but that's times 0. If I take U1 bar with U1, okay, that's the conjugate of that, is 2M times 1. And so on, you can see exactly the truth. This is all you're doing. It's just dot products of vectors. Or outer products of vectors in the case of 3, 112, and 113. These are easy little proofs. I mean, you can knock them out in 15 minutes. Once you see that, this is all you have to do. You can do it in a general frame, and that will push you up to 20 minutes.
Third.
Okay. But, you know, or, you know, if you're feeling like you've only got 15 minutes, do it in the rest frame and then notice that it's Lorentz invariant. then go home. All right. We have one for the V's as well. V bar R of P with V F of P. What am I going to get here?
Minus two.
Yeah. Okay. And then we also have relationships between the dagger guys. Right, these are the bar ones, right? Bar means you're multiplying by gamma zero. And gamma zero up here is one. If you don't have the gamma zero in here, and just do the dagger, you're going to, let's see, what are you getting? It makes a difference, it doesn't make a difference in the restaurant, just E or down. But it makes a difference in the other frames. It actually stays E instead of staying M. So the other set of relationships, you are dagger with U, F, again, both at momentum T. We get twice EP, Kronecker. And for V, VR, did you hang the book across that? Hopefully not my sleeve. Dagger. VR, P, dagger. V, F, P, is YZP of RF. Why no minus five? E is negative. So this is a minus sign, but he's got it.
Okay.
So that's a negative energy, that's a positive energy. Then we have an orthogonality. So the U's and B's are orthogonal to one another. So U bar R, D S is zero, and V bar R, U F is zero. So we have those as well as orthonormality here, that orthogonality between the particle and antiparticle. So these are actually a very sensible basis to be using. I mean, we've got these funny factors, but we've also put funny factors in the integrals, and they're there so that things have the right dimensions and all the pieces drop out in the right place. Okay, how are we doing? Question? Okay. So, what we need to do in order to pluck out particular terms here, let's see. Suppose we want to get A out of this first expression. So we've integrated psi past e to the I q dot x. How do I isolate this A? Well, I want to get rid of this. So what I'm going to do is multiply by, shall we say, U R dagger. That's going to give me a 2E times Kronecker R F. So fix some R, multiply by U R dagger, and so I get a Kronecker here. I said dagger because that gives a 2E, and that will combine nicely here. I don't know if I want a bar or a dagger there necessarily, but let's say dagger so that everything's in terms of energy. Okay, so I could use either one and then we still plug out that A with some coefficient. Then we need various other things. Okay, I could setting R equal to 1 or 2, I get AQ1 or AQ2. So let's write one or another of these someplace so we can
See what I'm talking about. Okay, so if I take you, where am I writing to you? U1 dagger. Then psi of x is t e to the I 2 dot x. Let's let this be of 2. And it does, I can put it inside or outside the interval. It doesn't matter. D3x. What's it going to give me? Okay, it gives me that expression multiplied by U1. So I'm going to get a Kronecker. I'm going to get 2E2 times a Kronecker 1F. I'm summing over all F, so it's just going to set F equal to 1. So then I have 1 over root 2E2. I have A to 2, 1. I've gotten rid of the spinner, but I get this normalization root 2E2, and then I have to worry about what happens to B. What happens to B?
Yeah.
B is orthogonal to U1, so I just get 0. So, bam, I solve for A.
That's easier.
Yeah. Okay, so we can, I could do it with 2, and I have a 2 here. So, in general, I have A, Q, let's say, R, for R equals 1 and 2. We have A, Q, R is going to be just that interval. U, R, of Q, dagger, psi, X, B, E to the I, Q, dot X.
You said it doesn't matter if it's inside the integral or not, but it's a function of q, right?
Integrals over x.
Oh, okay.
So,
right.
Yes,
yeah,
I got one.
Good.
Delta q.
Yeah. Well, see, that was easy. What's b? B of q and a general r. I do the same thing. Now I have to dot with some b's. So, I'm going to have a VR in here of Q dagger, psi of X, T, so these are the pilots, right? Psi. The only thing is, I'm going to have an I. So, let's bring it to the other side. And, oh, wait a minute, that's a V dagger. So, I don't do it this way. I know. Okay, this minus I gets rid of that I. But if I bring I want to bring a V R in from the right. So, here I have pi of X and G VR of Q E to the what was IQ dot X D3X. So this pi is a spinner. It's actually a conjugate spinner, so bringing VR in from the right is going to hit this V dagger. But I want the inner product, so I want a V dagger and a V. Otherwise I get some mix. Okay, so there we've gotten A and B, and we can take the daggers of those things, giving us everything in sight. So now we take what do I give her a raise there? Let's see, we're probably done with those. Are we done with those? Because I can take the daggers here, right? So I can take a dagger of
because you are, let's just see if I run into any unanswerable questions. So it's got a reverse stuff here. So I'm going to have a 5 dagger and a U R. And then he's the minus I, U dot X. So when I take a dagger, it's going to flip the order, but I still have a psi dagger and a U inner product. So I'm still taking a dot product.
Is there psi is made up of U's and R's, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm plucking out the U component of psi dagger. So yeah, the U1, U2, V1, V2 form a complete basis, and I just dot with each one. Like if it was I hat, J hat, K hat, you'd think, why did you bother? I know how to do that. But just all you are the Q's, and I don't even know what I'm doing. Alright, so let's compute the commutator of a couple of these things. Let's look at A with A dagger. Let's keep the Hamiltonian.
Did
something
just
veer in? Yeah. Alright. Yeah, Sam's going to be looking
for me around 4. Okay.
So, let's see. So we've got some P and some F dagger. We can probably do that. Anybody see what's wrong here?
Change X to Y. No.
Sorry, what? X, Y, where?
Are changing one of the X variables to Y instead of X? Or does it make a difference?
Well, I'll change one of those to Y.
We don't have commutation relations.
Right, that's it. Right. Oh, okay. These are fermions, it should be an anti-commutation relation. Now, I think in the field theory books online, I actually try to prove that. I try to show that if you take commutators, you're going to get the wrong sign for the energy and the charge. They'll be exactly opposite from what you want. So the energy will be the energy times the difference in particle number, and the charge will be the energy times, or the charge times the sum of particle numbers if you take commutators instead of anti-commutators. So basically, this should be normal order. one consequence of doing this is that the normal ordering of an A, say, C and F times an A dagger of Q and R is that when you flip them, you get a minus sign. So we define normal ordering, if you like, to give us that same sign because of the interchanged order. So we'll have a sign from the normal order. In general, we're going to want anti-commutators. Well, we need to be able to evaluate this. I guess I didn't write down the fundamental anti-commutator, so we should say first what phi is. The anti-commutator should give us, we've got, it's a density, right? So the anti-commutator of phi of x and t with pi of y and t equal time should be I del 3 of x minus 4. So there's our fundamental commutator for fermion field.
You're actually like an h-bar in there as well, like,
yeah,
h-bar
is one.
Okay.
Yes, there's an h-bar. Okay. Looks fine. No, without the h-bar. But, yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. So, we can use that on these expressions and see what happens. A dagger gives us... the integral without first here. So we have a d3x and a d3y. Then, let's see. There are q and t. So we're going to have, from a, we'll have u of q. That's going to be u r of q dagger phi of x and t. And then there's an e to the I q dot x. And the commutator with the other one, phi dagger, and now this is of this is going to be of y t, and then u r that would be f of p e to the minus I p dot x. Did I get it right?
Bring the same.
Okay, I'm trying to write this with R equal F, and that with X equals, let's see, yeah, this one I've got to replace Y and F.
My objection is I don't think, in the line above, the two EQs,
you know,
I don't think cancels. I think it's not a root 2 EQ, it's a full 2 EQ from to the bottom left here.
Oh, well, let's do that. All right, that's this is?
I think that's the one, yeah.
Because it was 2 here, yeah. Okay, so then we have a 1 over root 2EQ here. We'll have that everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Good.
I think you have each of the I minus IPY, right? The other one.
Here.
Yeah.
Minus IPY. Good. And then we have those 1 over root 2EP, 2EQ. Yeah. Okay. So, pi dagger. All right. Does anybody remember what pi was? We had pi. It was pi dagger. Was there a gamma zero or not? And was it minus? What was pi?
I.
Just that. Yeah. Okay. All right. So. Let's see. So if I can write this as 1 over I times pi of y and t, or minus I. And now I can take the anticommutator, and it gives me a delta function. It gives I times a delta function, so I times 1 over I, the I's go away. So we have d3x, d3y. Then we have u r of q dagger e to the I q dot x, and the anticommutator of psi with pi gives us del 3 of x minus y. And then we have a uf of t e to the minus I t dot y. And 1 over root 4 e t dq. Now we integrate d3y. Use the delta function. We've got ur of q dagger happily inner product with uf of t. Then e to the I q minus t dot x. Then there's going to be, let's see, that's the vector part, then plus I e q minus e t times time. And the energy denominator, 1 over root 4 e t e q. Okay, we can't do anything with this until t equals 2, but we get it because we're going to get a delta function here. We do the integral over x, and it gives us 2 pi cubed, del 3 of t minus 2. And then we can set t equal to q. So here we get ur of t dagger uf of t. Then this energy go away because those are equal, and we get a 1 over root 20 e t or q, let's call it t. And now this inner product of two spinners gives us 2 pi cubed, we get delta rf times 2e. We have 2e squared, it's 2et, square root of 4e squared. So this is the Kronecker rf times 2et, and it exactly cancels back to et. And so we have a Kronecker and a Dirac delta times the 2 pi cubed is exactly the sort of thing we want. Oh, that's good. So, homework. Work out B with B dagger. And as many more as you feel it takes to feel comfortable with it. Vectors, but they're really just four basis vectors, so you just dot them in and you get a Kronecker on those. So that's not actually so bad. And you get a... we're going to want an anti-commutator instead of a commutator. We won't see why until we compute the energy and the charge, right? If we had done this with commutators, if we set up canonical commutation relations, well, it just, alright, we have psi with pi, so it would have given the same thing. So there's no difference here if we use the commutator or an anti-commutator. Whatever we define to be the case, then we take that same one and we would get. So no difference yet. Next time, shall we put it off the next time, or do you want to start on energy? And how much time do we have?
It's four.
So four?
Oh, well, I don't know.
It just popped out. Okay. Yeah, it's a good spot, right? But when we'll compute the Hamiltonian operator and we'll compute the conserved U1 currents, we've already interpreted U1 currents as electric charge for various reasons. Gauge theory, or that's what works out for the scalar field, or, you know, there are various ways to see that that's the right thing. So we know what we'd like to get for those, but it won't work out right unless we have this fine convention for the canonical antimatter. So, you know, work it out ahead of me for Monday. Or other questions?
Why are we doing anti-commutation relations instead of commutation relations?
At this point, we have no motivation whatsoever for it. Right? Either one would have given us the same result here.
Okay.
Right. You can see that, you know, the only place that sign came in is when we used the definition up there. And so if I had used square brackets here and square brackets here, the answer would be the same. What I'm claiming in advance is when we compute the Hamiltonian operator, there's going to be a funny sign that comes up. And when we compute the conserved charge, the total charge of the Dirac field, there's going to be another funny sign that comes up. And the claim is that by taking anti-commutation relations for psi and pi, we can fix the funny sign. It'll work right if we do that. So we'll get there Monday. We should be able to compute the conserved quantity to see the time. Okay. Other questions? Yeah, it's funny. There's a reason in the bifunctional gauge theory for thinking of the exclusion principle. Probably other point of view, but may tie in when we start doing field theory there. You have dilatation in bifunctional space in general. And along any given path, you find out how much some dimensional quantity dilates by multiplying by the exponential of the integral of the vial vector along that path. For classical paths, that factor is 1. There is no dilatation along classical paths. But for quantum paths, the idea is that it's that dilatational factor that leads to path-dependent effects. And since in quantum mechanics we imagine we're probing off of the classical paths, we're allowing all possible paths to occur, then we do get non-trivial changes of sign. Now, if you have some particle that, you know, you start out with a couple of them together, say you take 2 electrons, and you evolve them along different paths and bring them back together, then, in general, now they have different masses. If they're allowed to follow non-classical paths, they won't have the same mass. But if you do 2 things, you can fix this up. If you never let 2 electrons occupy the same state, you can't bring them together. So you can't do that comparison that would yield a contradiction. And that means that if you never let these fermion world lines pass, world lines cross, then you can define a gauge such that the masses are always the same. So you define a gauge so the mass stays
constant for all your electrons, and you force them to satisfy the exclusion principle, and you can never derive any contradiction from it. So it may be that there's a whole other way to look at the exclusion principle. You might say, well, you know, they don't have to satisfy the exclusion principle, but when you do bring them together, they're going to have different mass. And you might be able to look at the problem from that perspective and see something totally, you know, gain a different insight into what's happening. It should be consistent with what we observe. But it may be that the exclusion principle is there because we insist on all our electrons having the same mass. That becomes possible if we don't let them close.
How different are the different?
How different? Well, since there's an H bar of the denominator, probably very different. Probably very different. If you look at a Schrodinger particle at rest, it's oscillating something like e to the minus I over H bar mc squared t. If you do a non-relative approximation of the Dirac equation, you know, phi at rest looks something like that. Well, this mc squared over H bar factor is, that's really how fast it's dilating. So, that's a big number, probably. Let's see, if mc squared is, say, an electron, we've got 511 keV, and h bar is 200 MeV Fermi, or that's h bar is T. So, that mc squared T over h bar is 511 keV, that's 0.511 MeV over, and I can put an extra T there and there, so I have 10 to the T, and then the denominator is 200 and Fermi. So, what is that? 0.0? Oh, oh. .0511 divided by 2 is 0.026, let's call it. So we get 0.026 dt over Fermi. So let's see. What time scale are we talking about here? That's 0.026 times 10 to the minus 15 meters times 3 times 10 to the 8 times t in seconds. So that's on the order of 10 to the 23rd, 3 times that 0.06, so 10 to 6 times 10 to the 21. T in seconds. So your factor is 10 to the 21. The exponential is 10 to the 21 per second. Fast.
Is that point go from this?
That's how fast the mass is changing. Right? Relative to what? Well, relative to how fast some other electron mass is changing. So it's not something we see. Right? But it could be that the world is expanding at an enormous rate, but unmeasurably. The small quantum effects we see are differences between the expansion rate on one path and the expansion rate on another. Quantum effects in general are very small. So the difference you would see along two different paths is going to be much, much smaller than that. So you should probably think in terms of enormous expansion rates, but minuscule differences. So maybe our experience is just telling us about that part of the universe that's expanding at approximately the same rate as we are, dilating, say, at the same rate as we are. And, you know, there are elements of the universe that are falling by the wayside because they're expanding at 10 to the 10th times slower, or 10 to the 10th times faster. They're already blossomed off into somewhere else, and we're incapable of experiencing them for one reason or another. It may be that it's only easy to measure things that are expanding at nearly the same rate as you, something like that. I don't know. Yeah, you can play with these ideas. It's interesting to think that, you know, maybe, you know, that's happening in the world. It may be that that what we regard as the world is the part that's expanding the fastest, and, you know, there's this other stuff trailing behind that just shrinks at an enormous rate and becomes utterly negligible, so that, you know, we're on this thin expanding surface of the world when, you know, the rest is getting left behind. Maybe that's a picture that makes sense. This is all speculation, right? I mean, it's up to you guys to do the calculations that make this all concrete. You know, the speculation takes 5 minutes. The calculation takes 5 years. You know, that's the difference. To make these ideas, you know, really something that you can do something with, have work to do.
I don't know if not H bar or C that's changing.
H bar, yeah.
Or C, yeah.
yeah, right. Is it H bar C or H C? The 200 NED Jeremy? Probably H bar, isn't it?
H bar,
yeah, factor of 2 pi exponentiated 10 to well.
There ought to be another zero in there. Did I lose a zero? What do you call it?
I multiplied by 3, so it became 0.06. Should be 0.07. Then let's see, we've got 10 to the 23, and I kicked off 2 decimal places to make the 0.06 into a 6. Where's the point? Should that have been 0.0? No, that's 0.026. Let's see, what's 100 into... Oh, there you go, up here you mean. That should have had another zero, right? So divide that by 100, I get 0.005. Yeah, here. So, you're right, there's another zero every place. And it's only 10 to the 20th. So, much slower. Exponentiated. So e to the 10 to the 20th. That's a fast expansion rate. But the question is, what can we measure of that? How much of that is detectable? And evidently, quantum field theoretically, we only see small deviations from the classical path. The stuff we look at is the perturbation theories around the classical path, and that's in powers of Planck's constant. So the deviations we actually look at are very, very small. So almost everything we're dealing with is expanding at that same rate, but you don't measure anything. You gauge it away. Right? In fact, with the Schrodinger equation, all right, this part of the wave function, that's exactly what you do with it. You gauge it away. Remember when you go from Dirac or Klein-Gordon to Schrodinger by a non-relativistic approximation, you find that you've got this mc squared term in the energy. And what do? You change the wave function by that phase so it goes away. It's just a phase transformation to get that out of the wave function in the Schrodinger equation. So at the level of the Schrodinger equation, you don't see anything of that rate. You might have high energy or something. But basically, unless you can
measure it with something that's not expanding anywhere near that, you know, that's not a measurable.
Can't work that out. I think it's easier for it, but yeah.
Work out which?
Going from Klein-Gordon to Schrodinger. Or,
Let me remind you. In a quick and dirty way is to solve for the energy about equal to mq squared, 1 plus q squared over m squared q4, 1/2, m squared q squared plus 1/2 times this times that, 1/2 t squared, let's see, that's an m squared c squared, so we cancel 1m and all the c's, so we end up with an m here. Higher order terms, but there's your p squared over 2m for the classical energy.
Right.
You also have this constant term from the rest of the, from the math. And so now you replace things by operators. So E is going to be replaced by IH bar ddt, and T is going to go to minus IH bar grad, and putting those in and letting them act on the wave function. You have IH bar d phi dt, and you can add a potential to the energy, right? So you get this minus h bar squared over 2m del squared phi from the v squared over 2m, and you get a v phi, but you also get this mc squared phi term from the math. But If you replace phi by a fancy phi is e to the minus I over h bar mc squared t times or let's take that to be the big one. So that one is equal to this times that. Then if I put that in, the time derivative is going to pull down the fact that it turns this into an mc squared phi times the exponential. That would actually cancel this term.
Okay.
So just by putting in that phase, you remove that term. But it kind of comes with that phase. You know, but we can't measure phases in quantum mechanics. You know, would be interpreted in a dilatation view of what happened as throwing out an overall rate of expansion shared by everything, roughly, and looking at different. Or choosing a gauge. You know, choosing a phase here corresponds to choosing a gauge, choosing a set of units everywhere.
December. Right, when we're, my home was crashed that day, right? Because I was, you know, I remember that scene.
Yeah, let's see. After the contraction, that makes sense. Although, let's see. The crucial thing is the weight of psi. What are the units of psi? That goes by 1.2, doesn't it? What did we find for the
scalar field?
Yeah. What's Dirac? Has Dirac action anywhere? Yeah. Oh, the same. So, 5R, 9L, 9X. So that's length to the fourth. Here we've got one over length. And then we've got the units of 5 squared. Oops, what's that here?
What over the cube?
So, by other half units, like 1 over length of the 3 half. So, yeah, negative. Okay. Nice sort of dark blue. Anybody know where Stan is? I didn't. I was supposed to meet her before, and I kind of assumed she'd come by here. That's pretty cheap. She went to my office. Don't ever go to my office to find me. I'm not there. Once in a while, I check to see if there are any phone messages. It's always someone trying to sell me car insurance. Yeah. Oh. They're amazing. So let's see, they're shrinking. Of course, it depends on gauge factor too, right? So if a positive weight thing was contracting, if all lengths were shrinking, then all your fermion fields would be blowing up. So it could go either direction. It may be possible to make some argument about observations, about measurability of these things.
Does that have anything to do with are they densities of fields? Kind of like, I mean, the momentum is density, right? So if the momentum of the pie is going down, it's the density, but if everything is expanding, of course, the density is increasing. Are they connected in that way?
Okay, actually, pi here has the same units as pi. So that's doing the same thing.
Well, it's sort of famous.
It was 1 over length squared for the scalar field.
So pi is decreasing as something is dilated. But pi is a density, so of course it's decreasing as everything else, as lengths are. Is that a logical connection?
Yeah, that works.
Okay.
Sure. So pi d cubed x is, the d cubed x is expanding, so the units of pi d cubed x, that's still minus 1, because that's the momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Momentum is still the units of 1 of the length. Does that work out? Pi. It's 1 over length squared. D cubed x would make it a length, not an inverse length. What's wrong with the trick? But I'm very sure that was our conclusion, that pi had the inverse length squared for the scalar. Okay. your notebook's getting saved.
I have to be paged every single day, so.
You should post that on the web.
Oh. Is there a way to, like, what is it? Like, make one document that references other documents or something, you know? I don't know.
One document out of the smaller one?
Right, right. Instead of, you know.
You could just do the, if you did the whole thing as one document, put it as chapters or something like that.
Well, you know, like, get a PDF of everything, you know, because I don't want to, like, put everything in one single document and try to change it because there's too much to scroll through. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Break it down by the functional section.
Right.
So.
I think like scientific word, you could actually reference other documents. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But.
There's probably a way to do it. I mean, it's easy enough to do it just the way that I'm sort of doing it on the course website, right? And just, you know, send me 20 pictures, or 20 pictures to link. You know, it'd be easy enough to list a half a dozen, you know, linked PDFs under one header so you can build content. You know, I'm not very smart about web pages, so just getting it out there, but, you know, we can probably figure out a way to do that. So that when you're looking at one document, you can link to the next.
Okay.
You can just keep going. I've seen that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, PDFs these days have links inside them. I don't know how they do that. You know, you pull down a paper off the web and it's, see you one. Have a good weekend. You know, all the references are actually a hot button. We'll take you to reference. That's really pretty cool. But I don't know how you do all that stuff. So I think we're solving by conforming the field equations. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
You
got that?
Well, I'm trying to write down what we know. I'm where.
Okay.
I don't know if you have learning for an hour or during this time, or I can't remember. Is it on Thursday? I don't know. No idea.
I hope you didn't go by my office.
Which is just that this is the sum of alpha and beta, this is beta, alpha was, well, we said it was our old solution right, so that the difference is that.
Yeah.
Okay, so then, was it our old solution though, that this is,
there's no curvature.
I still don't have curvature. Where beta is curvature.
Okay, no Riemannian curvature. What you have is no formal curvature. Look at the spin connection with the yield equation.
Oh,
not the yield equation, the pressure equation.
There's something besides the omega, which omega.
Yeah, there's that delta term, right? So you actually need to substitute in this solution and expand that all out. So the question is whether d alpha minus alpha wing alpha is zero or not. Okay, so if d alpha minus alpha wing alpha is zero, then you can write that. In fact, you can take lambda.
Very good,
right? Constant.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And even take lambda constant. So that alpha is zero.
Okay. Which is what I want to do. So
I think that's actually the answer here. But
right. Because then
that's what it hinges on.
Right. So if EA is DXA, or whatever the Latin.
It's probably okay.
Okay.
then yeah, then I want Alpha to be that. But that's the part that, so I'm trying not to be, I'm trying to be pedantic and not circular.
Right.
So I'm trying
yeah,
to,
good.
Second
thing is you better, let's see. No, we haven't proved that. No, well,
no, we haven't proved this. That's where my question is. I haven't proved this. I know that this is a function of X, but that's all I know. And so now what I have is I've solved the bile vector equation.
Mm-hmm.
I am still working on it. I have pieces of this one, and then I have those other two equations, but I don't need to. I'm trying not to go there until I have.
Okay, so what you have at this point is omega AB is alpha plus this thing here. There's a sign right there, that WC. What's WC?
WC is...
should be minus Y, right?
It's minus Y. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you want to be careful about the sign there.
I think it's right.
Double check. But...
The sign is because these are in the opposite order of the way.
WC is the scalar, not the form. I think this is correct. I think the minus sign with
okay.
W is right.
Okay.
So, right, omega AB is alpha plus this delta thing. And substitute into the spin connection equation. That's about the only place you can go from here.
Okay.
So you need to. Now, that's a big area of substitution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, no, I did something else and ended up proving something else.
Oh. Okay.
Which is always, you get to the end and you're like, oh yeah, okay, these two things are equal, I already knew that.
Yeah. And now, you do have some information about alpha. I mean, you know, alpha is the connection compatible with E. So, you know some things
so
about
maybe,
that from doing,
okay.
you know, general relativity.
Okay.
But hopefully what's going to happen is the alpha minus alpha delta will actually be zero by virtue of this solution for beta.
Right.
So what you want is for that extra delta term plus the d beta stuff. Right. So you've got a bunch of junk that's going to crop up. Right. So you've got d omega AB and omega CB omega AC or minus delta AC.
Omega,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or two baby curly arms like that.
Yeah. So.